I am David Fritzy, executive editor of Oklahoma Watch. We want to welcome you to our Oklahoma Watch Out public forum. It's the fifth one or sixth one what we've done. In case you don't know who we are, we're a nonprofit, nonpartisan online news publication, and we cover important public policy issues in Oklahoma, a range of issues, education, healthcare, and many more. And if you would like to learn more about us, please sign up for our weekly newsletter at the table outside and check our website, oklahomawatch.org. Tonight we'll be discussing mental and emotional health issues with our guests who are passionate and knowledgeable about the subject. We have Stephen Buck, Deputy Commissioner, Oklahoma Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services, and Michael Bros, Executive Director of Mental Health Association Oklahoma. Thank you for being with us tonight to discuss this topic.
Glad to be here.
Absolutely.
I should mention that Mental Health Commissioner Terry White was going to be attending this evening, but she had a sort of a last-minute conflict that came up. She was meeting with Governor Mary Fallon and some representatives from the medical community to discuss whether they could come to agreement on a prescription monitoring bill. So we'll see how that turns out. Stay tuned. Before we dive into questions, I want to thank our partners who have made this event possible, to the Ann and Henry Zero Foundation and Zero Families Foundation for enabling this event, and which is part of a year-long series we're doing on mental health called Trouble State, a series on mental health in Oklahoma. Also to Camp's 1910 Cafe for once again donating this venue, and to Oklahoma Public Media Exchange for providing their audio expertise. I should note that any opinions expressed this evening by the guests or anyone else are not those, not the opinions of any other organizations like Oklahoma Watch or Camp's 1910 Cafe. This is a simple format. It's Q&A. I'll start out with questions for our guests, and then we have two people who will be roaming the crowd. We'd ask you to please keep your questions as concise as possible. We only have an hour. We want to give in as many questions and answers as possible, and so we'll begin. I'd like to address the first questioner to Commissioner Buck. Oklahoma is known as a friendly place. That would seem to suggest that people are very happy here, but the numbers just don't back it up. 10th highest suicide rate in the nation. Close to 850 people dying of overdoses every year. 49th worst in prevalence of mental illness. 43rd in prevalence of illness for youth. 46th per capita in mental health funding. What's wrong with us?
Great lead-in question. Thank you. Well, first, let me say this. I want to express my appreciation to Oklahoma Watch for hosting this event and for all the sponsoring partners. It's a privilege, Mike, to share the stage with you tonight. Mike and I go back a number of years now, I can say decades, and there is no more passionate advocate in the state than Mike. So it's an honor to be here, and thank you to all who showed up here tonight. So the question before us really is a daunting one. Why is a state that is known for happiness, that is known for our friendliness, that's known for our engagement, why do these statistics exist? And I think one of the cornerstone reasons that we like to articulate is, why would it be a surprise for us, for a state that leads the nation in cardiovascular disease, leads the nation in obesity, leads the nation in tobacco-related issues, is a leader in the nation on the negative side among infant mortality reasons, why would a state that has all of those other negative health outcomes not also have poor mental health as part of its makeup? One of the things that we spend a lot of our time doing as an agency is articulating to policymakers and stakeholders a standpoint that mental illness and addiction are diseases that affect an organ of the body. In this case, it's the brain. And if we have unhealthy pancreases, if we have unhealthy hearts, if we have unhealthy lungs, it would be counterintuitive for our brains to not also be unhealthy. In answer to your question, we are a state that has a generally poor health profile, and it would only be logical then that we would also have a significant challenge as it relates to mental health and addictive disorders. And one other point I would make, and I think this is significant, is if you look at the historical trauma that's been experienced by this state, if you look at our child welfare data, if you look at the natural disasters, if you look at the ebb and flow of our economy, we know what trauma can do, certainly to a person's brain, and so I think those are also contributing elements.
Director Brose, do you have anything to add to that in terms of...
So in the U.S., for good reasons, we've really determined as a country that we are not satisfied with our veterans being on the streets, homeless, without the services that they need. And that commitment and that determination to address the needs of our veterans comes from the president, it goes through the Congress, it goes right down into the state houses, it goes into the governor's offices, and everybody in America has determined we're going to really take care of our veterans. As we look out across the country, the numbers of homeless, mentally ill veterans on the streets of our cities all over the country, those numbers are coming down. So why is that? Well, it's because we have decided to invest. We have decided that we have the technology, we have the programs, we have the services, we know how to do it, but it's about really ultimately at the end of the day, it's about investment, it's about political leadership of elected officials to say enough is enough and we're going to take this thing on. And that's no fault. I'm not faulting the department about that. I know that leadership and that vision with the Oklahoma Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services is there, but it goes up above them. It goes to into our state house and in our governor's office. We've got to address these and really invest in it. So we either invest downstream or we invest upstream. Downstream is prisons, incarcerations. Upstream is in prevention, in getting services to people. And so we've seen it with our veteran population where we've got a long ways to go, but we're making a difference. But I think that we could do it in all the areas that you just mentioned.
Mr. Brose, let me ask you, if there were two things that you could put in place, adequately funded right now, what would they be that would move the needle?
Well, I think obviously just absolutely more community-based services. I mean, across the board, everything from housing to more community mental health, more PAC teams, more outreach services, more access to medication, and that's more than two, but they all tie together under community-based services. So I think that would be one of them, services and more prevention services for our kids. So if you looked at the ACE studies, Adverse Childhood Experience Studies in Oklahoma, so there, here recently I talked about those ACE studies, if you guys are familiar with those. So I had two maps of Oklahoma up, okay? One of them was the rate of the impact of trauma. Steve mentioned that on our child, or our children, and adults too, but our children, and the long-term impact of that. And then the next map of Oklahoma right beside it was areas of poverty in the counties of the most poverty in our state. And it was absolutely shocking when you looked at those two maps together, because it just, you could have superimposed them. The higher the adverse childhood experiences, it marks right along with poverty. So I think we've got to address all of those things that, and I don't know if that gets to your question, but those are the things that stand out on my mind. There are others, but those are the two.
Commissioner, what are the chances that mental health will be getting more funding this year, or are you just going to be trying to hold the line?
We are always assertively making the case that the issues that we advocate on behalf of, that this group here that's interested in this advocates on behalf of, is worthy of additional funding. One of the things I will frequently articulate is you really cannot have a credible conversation about education in our state unless you understand the unmet needs of children in the classroom who are not learning because of a brain disorder. You cannot have a credible conversation about child welfare in our state unless you understand the needs of biological families and the substance abuse or untreated mental health that they might be experiencing. You can't have a conversation about economic development unless you understand that there are far too many jobs in our state going unfilled because we have a workforce that's not healthy enough to participate in the job market. And you certainly can't talk about corrections unless you understand there are far too many nonviolent offenders who are ending up there as a result of very minor crimes based upon substance abuse. So I give you that framing conversation to point this, that we will very aggressively talk to policymakers about the fact that investment in the services that we facilitate the provision of save money elsewhere in the budget. And if we can make that case adequately, I'm very confident that policymakers will understand and hopefully be able to invest additionally in our services.
Now, with the passage of the Affordable Care Act, despite the fact that Oklahoma rejected Medicaid expansion, there was hope that this would mean better and more mental health treatment. Do you share that hope?
Well, we, of course, the Mental Health Association Oklahoma, strongly in the past and currently support expansion of Medicaid to all of our citizens. 150,000 approximately Oklahomans still are in that coverage crater, as we refer to it as. And again, it goes back to, again, you're going to pay now or you're going to pay later. Honestly, in my opinion, I think our governor and our leadership in both houses originally supported it. I think politically they got attacked from their right and ultimately rejected that idea. And the reasons were because, well, when the federal government theoretically would back away from funding that, that would leave the state high and dry. Well, again, I think that, you know, we don't know that, and it gives us a chance, if we would move forward with that, to begin to measure and look at outcomes and see the effectiveness of that. I just had someone in my state, our state, from Connecticut, where they did Medicaid expansion, and it was amazing. I sat and just listened in wonder to her talk about all of the integrated services that they're doing, health care, mental health care, outreach, talking about having mental health, they're putting mental health professionals in ERs, they're putting mental health professionals in pediatricians' offices, getting funding for that, getting professionals' services paid for through Medicaid expansion and integration of services. Now, again, the Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services, they're doing everything they can. They are very actively working to expand and integrate services in every way they can, but it requires funding. To be able to get professional services, you've got to pay those professionals. So if we're going to do that, we've got to invest in that. So we're not going to stop advocating and communicating that. I know the department is talking about that to policymakers, but at the end of the day, we need big time political leadership, and I'm not talking about party here. I'm talking about red, blue, independent. It doesn't make any difference. We need political leadership in our state to address these issues.
Commissioner, now, under the law, mental health treatment is supposed to be on par with physical treatment. But yet, take California, for example. There are people, mental health workers, professionals, on strike for Kaiser Permanente because they're saying it's just not being done or offered by the insurers. Are we seeing parity here in Oklahoma?
You know, parity has been a really interesting pursuit. For Mike and I and some of us in this room, this goes back to 1999 when Oklahoma passed Senate Bill 2 by Angela Monson to introduce our state mental health parity statute, and we're still chasing true parity. Parity exists, but only when it's offered, I think is the bottom line as I understand the dialogue, in that if you're going to offer, there's no prescriptive authority that says this truly what constitutes an appropriate array of services to help somebody enter into and sustain their recovery. There's not that predetermined grid that's necessary to really support that person. So if you're going to offer something, we have that parity standard, but there's no specificity as to what truly needs to be offered. So depending upon the health plan you might enter, some people may enjoy a very robust set of benefits in their private health plan that is quite significant and quite adequate in meeting their needs. Unfortunately, there are other plans which meet the definition of parity, but maybe not the original spirit of those who authored the legislation that truly offers that robust set of services that are needed to help a person sustain recovery.
You know, again, I hate to refer back to my colleague that was in town over the weekend from Connecticut. It was real interesting with their Medicaid expansion. They've achieved parity and they're utilizing parity. Now they're trying to work with legislation to require the private insurers to come up and integrate and provide parity in the same way that Medicaid is being provided for parity and integration of services in that state. And I think that, you know, again, goodwill, I'm all for goodwill. Voluntary participation, I'm all for it. But sometimes we may have to, in some instances, push a little harder in a little different way to make sure that we do have true parity. It's one thing, you know, Steve's exactly right, man. When he was with NAMI, we were locked arms. We worked on that. We worked on that together, not only at the state level, we worked on it, but we worked on it at the national level, and we were able to achieve it. So, okay, we've got it in name and legislation. Let's get it in reality, and I think we're all working on that.
I'd like to open it up now to any questions from the audience. So you can just wave at someone who has a microphone if you'd like to ask a question.
My name is Angela Post, and I am one of those recipients that receive disability. My question is what I don't like is they are labeling nonviolent offenders and violent offenders. I have been a violent offender or whatever the case may be, but I have changed myself around, and I haven't received any services other than just a very few. So I guess what talk about that. I mean, why come it's just for nonviolent offenders? There's violent offenders that need that help as well. And some of those people you make and turn, not all, but some. What would you say on that?
That is a very, very fair question, and one that our policymakers, I'm sure, wrestle with. When they define what their policy is going to be in their elective state, the difference between nonviolence and violence is something they will typically play on within their constituencies. But what's really important is to understand that we do need programming across the board. That for us to truly be smart on crime as a state, for us to be smart on crime, and I love that coin that Commissioner White termed, we do need to be smart on crime. We have to understand that we have two obligations. We have an obligation to keep as many people on the front end from becoming involved in the criminal justice system as we possibly can. And then we have an obligation on the back end. When people who have served their time, sometimes for violent offenses, have served their time in Department of Corrections or wherever, that we make sure that we wrap the appropriate services around them as they exit to make sure they're provided opportunities to maintain a recovery in the community. Very candidly, I fear that far too often we have individuals who have needed and warranted services, and those services are not provided to them in prison. They reach their maximum time served, they're released to the streets, and they're released back to a system that may be foreign to them, significantly changed, and there hasn't been an opportunity to reengage in a supportive, recovery-oriented climate. So your point is right on the money. We do have to talk about people, regardless of their initial offense. For those who come back out, we have an obligation to make sure that those services are there to keep them from recidivating and going back into the system. I love your point, and thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's very common for people who are in an untreated state of mental illness to get into a situation where they begin to interact with law enforcement in some shape or form. It's a multifaceted approach. One is, again, high-end, very careful training for law enforcement. I know the department is very involved in that. I'm involved in that over right now in the Tulsa area. And so we've got to divert people out of that criminal justice system. And sometimes it's somebody who's in an untreated state of mental illness, and suddenly because they're symptomatic, and suddenly a law enforcement official, and I believe me, they have a tough job. I'm very sympathetic about their situations, what have you. But sometimes suddenly it turns into resisting arrest or assault on a police officer. Well, that's a violent offense, what have you. And so they go to jail. So then maybe in an untreated state, maybe then suddenly something happens and they have an assault against a correctional officer because they're not getting treatment in the jail. So now they're stacked up. They can't get out of jail. They're going to eventually get out. We're going to release them. And they're going to release them. Now they can't get a job. Now they can't have trouble finding housing. And so where it's left? Poverty, returning to some sort of, or going, utilizing some sort of criminal activity potentially, but poverty, untreated state. So we've got to figure out how to divert people out of that criminal justice system. My organization employees, we have about 150 employees total. We buy individual, anonymous, voluntary survey. One out of four of my employees has a felony conviction. I don't know what kind they are. I don't care. They're great employees, and people say to me all the time, well, isn't that sweet of you guys to hire those sweet people? And, you know, I say, you know what I say? I hire them because they're good employees. That's why I hire them. All of us in this room deserve grace and mercy, right? We've all made mistakes, and people have a chance to change. People who get on, you know, treatment, get better, have opportunities. We all need to provide those chances to people, and that needs to be embedded in our diversity planning. It isn't just diversity planning around race, ethnicity, religious background is very important. Let's expand diversity to include people who have histories of incarceration, felony convictions, people with mental illnesses, people with histories of substance abuse. Let's expand that where they can have a chance to get employment, get housing, and get on with their lives, and they become productive, tax-paying members of our communities.
I have a question. If I'm a parent and I have a mentally ill son, or I have a brother who lives in a house nearby who's having, obviously, is disturbed, do they know where to turn, what to do? Mr. Buck, do you think the message is getting out there?
I do think the message is getting out. I think, and so when I started in this field back in 1998, I can tell you it was a very different environment. Back in 1998, mental health associations were just kind of an organization that was out there, known within a certain pocket, but not really a mainstream organization. NAMI was this four-letter acronym that nobody could recognize, you know, knew what National Alliance on Mental Illness meant. I'm using those as two examples. And you have the emergence of these tremendous organizations like mental health associations, like NAMI, like DBSA, like OCARTA. And so you have all of these very significant groups of people who are focused on these issues that have emerged. So I think the template of becoming, or the opportunity to become engaged now, is so much better than it was then through social media and through a very important period of what I'll call stigma eradication that has begun to occur around mental illness and addiction. I think we're becoming more comfortable. We're not there yet, but we're becoming more comfortable talking about these circumstances and these illnesses very differently than were just two short decades ago. And I credit those organizations for helping drive that and for introducing that. So I think there's a lot of help out there for those circumstances. I will further say, I so applaud the work that's been done, and I'll specifically mention CIT programs, crisis intervention teams. I so applaud the fact that law enforcement in so many communities is not being seen by families as adversarial, but actually partners in the community. That you have a policing approach that says that if somebody's in crisis, we are there to address that person as somebody who is in need, as opposed to somebody who is a threat. And just some of the stories that come back to us anecdotally of the way CIT officers have engaged consumers who are in the midst of crisis, who were truly seeing and experiencing things that would scare any of us to death, and to hear the stories of how the officer has articulated and been empathetic and talked down the situation, we are at a better place. We're not all the way there, but we are in a better place.
Well, you know, it's been well publicized, but everybody here, I'm sure, has heard about the event where the young man in an untreated state, symptomatic, crashed into the Ten Commandments. It wasn't very long that we got connected up with his sister, and she explained to us mental illness affected him. He was in an untreated state, symptomatic, delusional, and this occurred. And because of all the publicity around that, the Department of Mental Health, the Mental Health Association, Oklahoma, the district attorney here, Griffin Memorial Hospital, the sheriff's office, the police department here, everybody worked together. There was enormous communication. There was enormous effort. He was diverted into treatment. His symptoms were addressed. They were mitigated. He's back in his community. There were no charges filed. He is back in his community. Now, we can all say, well, man, that ought to happen in every instance or something. That's the outcome we're looking for all the time. The reason why we were able to get that outcome is everybody pitched in and it had a lot of publicity. But I think that we could get that outcome a lot more often than what we do. I don't envy law enforcement. They have a tough job. They deal with these situations much more than they deal with situations where they get a lot more training than they do on this. It is incumbent upon us to provide that help and that training, CIT training, to them, and it's incumbent upon them to ask us for it. They have to get 2 hours a year of in their CLEAT certification mental health training. I can tell you for sure, not every department in the state of Oklahoma gets really high-end in-service training in that. Sometimes they've told me this. Sometimes they just put a tape in and play it, and it's the same one we played last year. We check a box. We met our criteria. That's not good enough. But again, I want to say good things about the department, because they do a great job of reaching out to those departments and those training academies around the state of Oklahoma.
Are there other questions out there?
Now, I'm here without my sidekick, Donna Woods, but I've worked with Donna, and I've worked with her organization, OCARTA. They deal more with substance abuse and co-occurring. I'm the executive director of the Depression Bipolar Support Alliance, so I'm going to bring up a taboo subject, okay? You're never going to find spiritual disorder listed in the DSM-5, but mental illness, maybe it's not a disease of the brain, unless you say it's a disease of the brain caused by a spiritual disorder.
Well, it seems like your question would be, should spirituality or faith play a greater role in trying to intervene to help people with mental health issues?
I have a lot of faith-based friends, and it's interesting. Sometimes they think that we're against faith or religious practices, and we see that as every bit a part of everyone's recovery, whether that's from a more structured 12-step setting all the way to people being engaged in a place of worship of their choice. We reach out to, I was just this afternoon over meeting with some pastors over at Victory Christian Center in Tulsa, a huge church there in South Tulsa, and we're talking about and planning partnerships. And we reach out wherever we have our housing. We always reach out to the faith communities that surround there, reach out to them. It's real interesting. We find that they need as much education about people affected by mental illness as the person who's affected needs what they have to offer. It's a very much of a two-way street. Absolutely, we absolutely support spirituality, choice of worship as a part of the whole recovery experience, always.
Jenny, you have a question over there?
Good evening, gentlemen. I really appreciate you being here this evening. I was at a very interesting meeting last week where Representative Bobby Cleveland made a very good presentation. He is the new chairman of the Public Safety or Public Health and Safety, and his presentation was remarkable, that we do need to make a lot better use of our drug courts, our mental health courts, and our veteran health courts. What do you see in the way of legislation? And also, how effective do you see these type of courts in not only doing what you're talking about? He also made the statement it costs $25,000 a year, I believe it was, for incarceration, $5,000 a year for mental health.
Mr. Buck?
First of all, Representative Cleveland, who he's referencing, has, to his credit, I believe Representative Cleveland has personally visited every single correctional facility in the state over the last 6 to 8 months. He has taken this on his own initiative, and I have been with him on a couple of those visits and watched him visit with the offenders in those facilities, and has a lot of personal dialogue and personal investment on this. So what he's bringing in that presentation, what I think he'll bring to the Capitol, is not some recitation of a textbook. I think he's bringing into the dialogue what he has learned personally from doing this. You mentioned drug courts and mental health courts. The wonderful things about those, it takes zero policy change to make either of those realities for Oklahoma. They both already exist. What it takes is our state saying that we believe it's much more economically appropriate and humane to serve somebody in a diversionary court than it is to send them to DOC. It becomes a resource issue. Your statistics are right on. We know that for somebody in a drug court or a mental health court, it's $5,000 to $5,400 a year. For somebody in DOC, $19,000 for a normal correctional bed, $23,000, $24,000 if it's somebody with significant mental illness. My college degree is in economics. I didn't need an economics degree to tell you that I would much rather spend $5,000 than $20,000.
Other questions out there?
Hello, my name's Caitlin McElroy. I have several degrees ranging from biology to behavioral studies. And you brought up a point about 12-step programs, and that's slightly concerning because research has shown that these programs have very little effectiveness. Actual studies that are well-controlled don't show that they're effective. Actually, effectiveness is about 20%. So that's less than chance. So I was just concerned when you bring up that 12-step as part of recovery and something that you're pushing people towards when it has such a low effectiveness rate. It's something that was brought into the United States by two people, I think it was in the 1930s, and they were alcoholics and they helped each other and they helped other people. However, the book is based on when he was having a psychotic break, and a lot of it has to do with God. And if you look at, there's some programs that are for atheists and the 12-step programs, but how can you have an atheist program when the central tenets of the 12 steps are so linked to a higher being, and not just a higher being, but specifically God?
Your question is whether this program...
Well, actually, this isn't a question. This is a statement to help clear up people's misunderstandings about the 12-step
I think it gives
programs.
Rise to a good question, though, and that is, how do we know some of these programs work? Is there data? Is there evidence? Many things are rolled out like question, persuade, refer, which I know the Mental Health Association has pushed, and that's a national issue. And there have been news stories about the 12-step program. So, you know, is there evidence, or is it just throwing spaghetti against them?
More and more, it's been... an incredible growth of programs that are funded have to be evidence-based and have to be proven. Now, you know, one of my issues related to that is that I want to make sure that there's still room for emerging practices. I think sometimes those things, I always say evidence-based practices weren't born evidence-based practices. They were developed and emerged and grew, and then they were measured, and then it was proven to be that they were in fact effective. And so, but I think that more and more it's getting harder and harder to secure funding for programs that you want to implement unless you're actually using an evidence-based practice. So I think that is a very important issue that will continue to grow and be looked at all the time. The department does that. We hire independent evaluators outside of our organization to be able to help us determine that they are in fact are effective.
Mr. Buck, I'd like to ask a quick question. Do you think many doctors ask their patients on a routine basis whether they're having mental health issues? And should they? And if they aren't, is there a way to get that message out?
Yeah, fantastic question. When I do new employee orientation for our employees, I always make the joke about my family physician, and she's absolutely terrific, and I love my doctor. She takes great care of our family. But we have to fill out that pink sheet when we go out there, and it's a pink sheet in her office, and it's the one that asks your history, and you have to check off, do you have these conditions, have you had surgeries? Then you get down to the substance abuse, substance use questions, tobacco use, all of those questions. And I am absolutely convinced that if I wrote that I was consuming a 24-pack of beer a day, that she would never get there during my visit. And I think she's a great doctor. And it's because these issues have been so separated from our discussion about physical health and behavioral health, if you will. And, you know, the converse is true. If you think about a psychiatrist's office, how many psychiatrist's offices you have, did you see a blood pressure cuff? You don't necessarily see it. It's an important part of integration that we need to do. Are there things that we can do? A perfect example is a program called Screening Brief Intervention Referral to Treatment, SBIRT. It is a model that has been demonstrated in research study after research study that says that if we will apply appropriate screens as it relates to substance use, we can truly identify those that are most dependent, divert them to treatment. We're going to screen out the majority of people because their use is such that it doesn't indicate any risk. But there's this group, and it's a large group that's in the middle. And with the appropriate intervention, that appropriate counseling by your medical care professional that says, you know what, you're really flirting with use here that may put you at a higher risk of addiction or an issue to do to your abuse, that a majority of people will tip back into a range that is not as dangerous to their health. And the evidence on a program like SBIRT is really extensive. And it's things like that that need to become as routine in our primary care visit as checking our blood pressure and checking our pulse. Behavioral health checkup should be part of that primary care norm.
Other questions?
Hi, I'm Jacqueline. I'm a reporter at The Oklahoman. In other states, like New York and Florida, they've tried Kendra's Law, the Marchman Act, other legislation that allows court systems to mandate outpatient treatment. I know that a similar model is being discussed. It's been presented by Representative Lee Denny. Is the Department of Mental Health planning to support that bill?
We have not yet completed the analysis of our bill. We're aware that bill's out there, and we'll be discussing it. The advocacy community has been very, very good in talking to us about what they wanted to accomplish with that legislation. So we look forward to the dialogue with Representative Denny on that. Again, we haven't looked at the bill. There's new language this year. There are fiscal impacts for the state in doing this, and those are things that need to be analyzed. So, to answer your question, Jacqueline, it's something we're definitely looking at and something that we will be evaluating and visiting both with the advocates, partners, the Coalition of Advocates, as well as the members of the Capitol. The one thing I want to comment, though, about this, and this in no way is disrespectful of important tools like AOT, Assisted Outpatient Treatment, or Advanced Psychiatric Directives, is I will be very excited when we reach the point that when we allow somebody to decompensate to the point that they need that type of intervention, that's almost a treatment failure, and that's almost a societal failure. Because I think it's all of our best interest if we can start identifying people who are at risk of psychiatric distress much earlier in their disease progression. Because by the time you've reached the point that an assisted outpatient treatment order or a civil commitment, whatever it may be, by the time that's ordered, we have sacrificed family productivity, we have sacrificed employment, we have sacrificed education. So AOT is going to be an important discussion. It's one of the things out there that will draw some attention this year. But I also look forward to moving the conversation upstream and really talking about that earlier intervention.
I believe there's a question in the back.
Hi, David from Oklahoma City. It seems like back to economics. I mean, obviously, you guys are right on the economics. But how much of it also that the state budget, Oklahoma policy talks about how over $500 million in tax credits and subsidies come out of the budget before you can even do anything. And with the economy supposedly going well, our budget is going to have a $300 million shortfall. How much of this is on the back of the what used to be good corporate citizens are now very good at extracting money from the state budget for services versus necessarily for the people of Oklahoma?
May I?
Sure, go ahead.
The budget situation is interesting that because of just the dialogue around it, we've seen a lot of attention to it. But when you look at the chronic underfunding of mental illness and addiction, when you cast that net, you need to look back into, I believe it's 91 or 92, when our trend began to bend in the wrong direction. This is a decades issue for our state. We've allowed this underfunding to perpetuate for far too many years. It's up to people a lot smarter than me to determine the best tax policy for the state of Oklahoma. They can have that conversation. That's not mine. The conversation I will continue to make is that if you think of the three goals that have been stated as the governor's priorities for her next 4 years, educational attainment and workforce, health care, and correctional policy reform, I would argue the issues we're here to talk about tonight are germane and very central to each of those three policy areas. So I think we have an incredible opportunity to start talking about those items that we're passionate about as it relates to the state public policy priorities.
There's a question right here. Go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to the issue of when the Ten Commandments were destroyed. And I think that when it did happen, there was a tremendous amount of coverage, both on TV, newspapers, Facebook, everywhere. But when I didn't even find out the results of what happened to that young man until much later, and then it was almost by word of mouth. And I think it was a golden opportunity that the media totally missed as far as educating the public on the cooperation between the agencies to get this particular person the help that he needed. And so looking back at that, what can you do to make future incidences, which are you know are going to happen, how can you make that something that is an education for the public? Because if the public doesn't get that information, then their opinions remain the same.
Well, I think we had great success, in my opinion, early on right after it happened. There was kind of that initial negative sort of focus on what had happened. And then we had a chance to connect his family up with a number of media outlets, including Oklahoma Watch, The Oklahoman, OETA. We were able to do that to let them tell the story of who he really was. And you're right, it went into kind of a silent phase while things were happening and going on. It was really kind of hard. There was confidentiality involved. There was a lot of different things that were involved in that. But if you, I don't know about where it, how it covered here, but I know in Tulsa, the same day that it was announced that the new Ten Commandments had been restored, on that exact same day, it was announced that he had been back with his family successfully. So it wasn't perfect, but we used everything we could to educate the public as much as we possibly could.
Mr. Brose, I want to ask, there seems to have been a lot of discussion about early intervention, about how it will take a decade before anyone realizes someone has a mental illness or mental health problem. How can we get at that?
Well, I think one of the things at our Zero Symposium last year, we had a spokesman there from the National Institute of Mental Health talking about the RAISE project, which the Department of Mental Health is involved in it. And it's really about really trying to address that robust intervention, treatment, care, wraparound services across the spectrum, housing, outreach, employment needs, mental health needs, economic needs of that individual at the first onset of when their symptoms appear the first time. And the research is really clear that when you're able to effectively do that, the person has really great outcomes of returning to their original baseline before the illness manifested itself and be able to go on and live their lives in a productive way.
What about in schools? Can you get into schools? Should we go on that early?
We are getting into schools. We're doing screening in schools. You know, on the way over here, I had a program that we homegrown and developed called Safe Team. I got a call from a school counselor saying, I need more information about Safe Team. We've been doing teen screen in communities all around the Oklahoma City metro area, in the Tulsa metro areas, in other areas of the state of Oklahoma, getting into schools. Many, many schools are very open to us coming in. But you know what? It's interesting. We have to have parental permission to be able to screen their child in the schools. We have a lot of parents that are reluctant to allow us to give that permission. Again, I think that goes back to the stigma, the fear, the misunderstanding. We have a lot of education to do related to this at all levels and all walks of life.
Other questions?
My question is, how much have you involved the mental health providers that prescribe the narcotic drugs that cause some of the problems with people being jailed because of the fact of overuse and things like that, where, you know, if they had not taken that drug, they would have not gotten that situation. And physicians that do that are perpetuating the situation for the mental health problems.
Right on target with the question. You might recall that we opened that one reason Commissioner White's not here tonight instead of me is she's in a meeting addressing this very important discussion. This is a central discussion, I believe, for Oklahoma. We know, and I might be off one or two on the number, that for every 100 Oklahomans, there are 118 scripts for these narcotics. It's another area that we lead the nation for all the wrong reasons. We don't want to be number one, number two, number three in this list of overdose deaths, of all of the consequences. And so you will see considerable conversation at the Capitol about this year as we continue to address this as a state. It's absolutely imperative.
You know, just anecdotally, one of my employees, he was a veteran. He needed a knee replacement. He put it off for a long time. He lives in recovery from substance abuse. He put his knee replacement off because he was worried about, his doctor said, you're going to have to be on some heavy medication for a short period of time. So he worked very closely with his doctor, his surgeon, and also with his sponsor. And they worked him through that and got that and brought him through that. And he was able to very successfully work through that and maintain his recovery, his sobriety. But they were able to address his pain. That's how it ought to work with every single patient in something like that.
Other questions?
My question is about the medical field. It seems to me there's a breakdown as far as getting somebody in the system for the proper treatment. Here in this state, I've had challenges where you go to a crisis center and they just give you medication to sleep it off and send you home. It's hard to get in there and get the proper treatment and follow-up when somebody's ill. That only doesn't only affect the person, it also affects the family. So I've had them call it the HIPAA laws or the rights. You can't even talk to a psychiatrist because they say there's rights, and so they don't really give you any way to help, you know, follow up with their treatment plan and the best healing for a person in the state here.
Buck, do you think there's...
So, relative to the question, in services and crisis centers, and I'm assuming you're referring to psychiatric crisis centers, would be my assumption you saying that. I'm not a clinician, so I can't speak specifically to some of the clinical statements you made, but I can tell you that our crisis centers, I believe, work very diligently to do the best they can to provide services in the context of the individual who is stepping in to receive the services at that moment. That is a very traumatic period of time for the individual involved in services. It's a traumatic time for the family, and the treatment providers are doing their very best to determine whether somebody is warranting of a civil commitment or whether or not they can go home absent of that step. So I'm not in a position to comment specifically on any circumstance that may or may not have occurred there. But I can tell you that they work very hard to introduce therapies and services that are the best that they can offer based upon what current science is.
I'm going to put a little different spin on it. I am a licensed clinical social worker. I've been involved in providing care to people for many, many years now. And I think some of it is about the philosophy of care. And if your philosophy is that, well, you know, we're going to treat this individual and things get a lot more complicated when we include that family. Now, you know, over the years, it's about my skills of getting, encouraging my patient to understand that it's in their best interest that I get that family involved as quickly as possible. I wish I had a quarter in my pocket for every family member who's told me that they worked and scraped and struggled to get their loved one to a crisis center. They go home, they take a deep breath, they call down to there and to find out how their loved one's doing, and they say, well, we can't admit or deny your loved one is there at all. Oh, but guess what? At the time of discharge, suddenly they remember who you are and they call you up and ask you to come and pick up your loved one. You know, and so it's about the clinician's skill in working with their patient to get that release sign. Are there things that my client and I might talk about that's nobody else's dang business? Absolutely. But we need to involve that family because they're going to go home or they're going to go back in the community, and that family is going to be heavily responsible and involved in their well-being and care. And so we need them as a clinician. I want that family to be my partner in the well-being for their loved one. So that's the Mental Health Association Oklahoma's position on that, and I understand absolutely what Steve said. I agree with that, but we need to better train our clinicians and examine our own philosophies as mental health professionals about how we address that.
You know, I'll mention that we borrow some things from other states and then completely ignore others that are working. In mental health, what might some of those ideas be? And I'll mention one that's brought up that's gotten publicity, and that's San Antonio, creating a basically taking patrol officers out of patrol and making them mental health officers. Madison, Wisconsin is doing the same thing. Any chances that'll happen here? Will it work?
You're referring to Bexar County, Texas, I believe, and some of that. Bexar County has a very robust set of circumstances. We have many of those elements in place. One of the things that frustrates me in my role is that if you look across the spectrum of services that are offered in this state, you will find programs of excellence all over the state that truly represent the best in mental health and addiction delivery. The trouble is you cannot find them all in one community. And so you may live in the Oklahoma City area and have access to services 1, 2, or 3, but really what you need is 4, 5, and 6, and you can find those in Tulsa. But Tulsa doesn't have 1, 2, and 3. And so we really have done a good job of articulating some of those very specific programs, putting them into place. But to answer your question, I mentioned earlier ESPRT. We are woefully behind the nation in the implementation of ESPRT. ESPRT has been proven by 20-plus gold standards as a way to identify people very, very early in their addictive and abuse cycle and diverting them into a more healthy alternative, whether that be diverting them or correcting use or getting them into treatment earlier. That would be one specific example that we hold out there as a place that we really need to get.
So I reached out to one of the police officers on that mental health police unit down in San Antonio, and we had him up to Tulsa. We've now taken a cohort of police officers, sheriff, deputies, mental health professionals down to San Antonio to look at that program. We're planning another trip down. But I was talking to him, and he said, Mike, he said, we have done a magnificent job of diverting people with mental illnesses and in crisis out of the jails and out of the criminal justice system. But guess what? We put an amazing amount of strain on the treatment services as a result. And my response to that is, that's where we need to put the pressure. So then that will drive more funding towards that, not the other way around. So let's put the pressure there and out of the criminal justice system, but into the treatment system. That's where we need to. And so it was very interesting talking to him and visiting with him about that.
Other questions? Oh, there's one.
Yes. We've talked about how the media took the story of the young man with the Ten Commandments. Several of us in the NAMI Edmond North OKC group had a chance to see the new crisis center. Very nice. And we were told that each month they have about 400 people who were admitted there and dismissed. We also met one man who was supposed to be the person who helped somebody when they were dismissed find services in the community. Most of the people did not get any services when they left. It speaks to your point, Mike.
You're saying there should be more media coverage of...
Yeah, I just want to congratulate. I mean, on the other side of that, our media, Oklahoma Watch, the Oklahoman, Tulsa World, OETA, there is a lot of media interest in this topic, and we're trying to also use then tie that into social media and use that. And we ask all of our audience, when you see those stories, push those out through your networks to help us get that out there. This needs to be a statewide conversation. This is where the conversation starts. You all are to be applauded. There's a lot of things you could be doing tonight. You're right here because you're passionate, interested. Get your neighbors, get your parishioners of your church interested. We need to create a statewide debate, discussion, dialogue about this that goes far beyond camps tonight.
Question there.
I'm Warren Veith with Oklahoma Watch. Mr. Buck, tens of thousands of Oklahomans are addicted to prescription painkillers, and my understanding is many of them would like to check themselves into inpatient drug rehab programs, but they can't get in. How long is that waiting list now, and is the department planning to do anything in the near term to try and deal with that?
So the response, the question asked about our residential waiting list. One of the tragedies experienced in our state, and to answer his question, it's a tragedy because, as you all know, those of you that have lived this personally in your family, as you all know, by the time their name gets called, they no longer have the motivation to become engaged.
Right.
A more tragic consequence has occurred, and they're already behind bars, or, God forbid, something else worse has happened. What are we doing as a department? We continue to articulate that need. It is a significant part of our budget request for the upcoming year. Whenever the state was going through its recessionary period of 2009, 2010, we took 95 desperately needed state-funded beds out of the system as part of that response. Those are 95 beds that we once had that no longer existed. It is an area of utmost priority.
It's also huge economic disparity. I have all kinds of people call me with this issue, and I have to ask them questions about finances and insurance, what have you. If you got a lot of finances, you have great insurance, there's a good chance I can get you somewhere. But for the rest of us, it's highly unlikely it'll be the situation that Steve just described. And as he said, timing is everything. With this particular issue, people are ready to go. Let's provide it to them. Again, pay now or pay later. It's not always that we need a new dollar. We've got to look hard and long at how we spend the dollar we have. We're backloaded. We're downstream. We've got to make the hard choices to move and move upstream. And that gets hard because people will politically protect their self-interest in their jobs and their communities, and we have to shift it around where so we can move upstream and spend the dollar that we have more effectively than what we are using right now in many instances.
We'll take just a couple more questions.
You make the comment about spending our dollar more wisely. Earlier tonight, we had a conversation about mental health courts and how much more cost-effective they were than incarceration. If they're so much more cost-effective, if they've been proven to work, why aren't they available across the state of Oklahoma?
Question relates to mental health courts. Currently, Paul, there are either 16 or 18 DAs who have actively requested funding for a mental health court in their respective jurisdictions. So it's certainly not a demand or an interest issue. When you parallel the growth of mental health courts to drug courts, realize that the state chose to invest in the mid-2000s, early 2000s, mid-2000s, double-digit millions of dollars in order to promulgate the availability of drug courts in the state. The total state spend on drug courts now is about $20 million. If you parallel that towards the investment that's made in mental health courts, there's no comparison between the two. To really fuel growth in the mental health courts, we need to make the case that that investment is warranted for the state.
Yeah, I want to also kind of, with that same topic, go back to what Steve's great point earlier about, you know, if we have to use an involuntary commitment, that's a bad outcome. It's a necessary evil sometimes, but it's the same thing. Remember, if you're in drug court or in mental health court or in veterans court, that's post-felony. That's moving downstream. So while we need more of those and we need more funding, in my opinion, to expand those, ultimately our goal is to put those things out of business so people are never get into the criminal justice system and they don't need that. If we get the good outcomes, we get the early intervention, we won't need all those courts or we won't need to be using involuntary commitment near as much as we did. So I want to make sure that we keep that in mind on a continuum, upstream and not downstream.
Final question.
My name's Jean. So my question is, how do we get to those people who don't understand in our legislature? What kind of strategies have you found work? So give us an assignment.
You know, I've been using the same tired response, and I don't mean tired in a negative way, but I'm a true believer in simplicity is best. And, you know, Tiff O'Neill, former House Speaker, coined as part of his book, All Politics is Local. And I truly believe that there is no better marching order for this group than to realize and recognize the fact that all politics is local. And that starts with having relationships with your individual representative and senator in their districts as they're working in their district to support their constituents. An important illustrative example for me of that. Last year, we know that there were 25 to 30,000 teachers and education supporters who showed up for the rally. I long for the day that we have that many Oklahomans out front arguing as aggressively and passionately for services for the people we care about. But what's essential is not just showing up at the rallies and making noise, it's building that individual relationship. So when that individual senator or House member is contemplating very hard budget decisions, that they think back and they say, what will Gene hold me accountable for? It's those types of relationships, I think, that will make the difference.
I totally agree with what Steve said. I couldn't agree more. But I wanted to come at it from a little different angle. So I don't know how many of you saw a recent editorial going around the country talking about the Koch brothers and George Soros talking about the inappropriate, ineffective use of the criminal justice system to address social ills. George Soros, the Koch brothers, really? I mean, that's as far apart on the political spectrum as you could possibly get. But here it is. So it's a chance for also, let's get red and blues together across those party lines and get them on the same page. We all have the same economic interest. We all have the same outcome interest. I don't think it really is about parties. I think it's about awareness, education, and finding people who will work across those party lines and get out of this extreme partisanship world that we live in right now.
Commissioner, Director, thanks for your time. Thank you for coming.